Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. We have a lot to share today. In our health and nutrition segment, we'll be talking about fish-eating vegetarians have the lowest risk of colorectal cancer, according to the Journal of American Medical Association, how breast arterial calcification is a strong indicator of coronary arterial calcification. For those who concern themselves that maybe if they took calcium supplements, it could cause a coronary artery calcification in rheumatoid arthritis, no link. Omega-3 fatty acids help heart attack survivors, and low levels of the omega-3, not a good thing, are an increased risk of intracerebral hemorrhaging. Plus, migraines are linked to certain heavy metals, and exercising early allows a longer life, and the non-toxic options for parents not wanting to vaccinate. My guest in the second part of our program from London will be Professor William Davies. He is a sociologist, a political economist, and a senior lecturer at Goldsmiths at the University of London, where he's director of the Political Economic Research Center. And we're going to talk about the social impact of neoliberal capitalism and the role of technology and how governments and big corporations and businesses sell us happiness and well-being. Okay, you mean we buy those things that are meant to make us feel happy and well. Also today, I'm going to offer a different perspective on Bernie Sanders, along with Paul Street of Counterpunch. I believe that if you took a look, an honest look, at the things that Bernie Sanders really stands for, you'd have a different perspective. He is not progressive on any of the important issues. But we'll take a look at that. Also, I'll play a segment, The Lie We Live. I think you'll find it a fascinating commentary on interesting questions that we're not even willing to ask. And we have back today America's favorite Christian, Betty Bowers, talking about goodwill to few men, as in Goodwill Industries. We're all familiar with that, and I've donated lots of stuff to Goodwill. Well, she has some thoughts on that. Also from the BBC, we'll talk about the chip that they're now really lining up, and people are getting this chip putting into their skin. And from Roger Waters, Amused to Death. And also a special tribute today to a leading holistic cancer doctor who died yesterday, Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez. I knew Nicholas well. In fact, we had filmed him recently for a new documentary, and I'll give you my history with Nicholas and what he contributed and why he should be remembered in a very positive light. And he was only, I believe, 66 or 67 years of age. Let's begin with the latest on health and healing. First and foremost, we have the omega-3 fatty acids, and we know how important the omega-3 fatty acids are. Now, I, as a vegan, can get my omega-3 fatty acids by eating flaxseed oil and putting a teaspoon of flaxseed oil. Also, it's good to have it with raw coconut oil, and you can use it pumpkin seed oil. I'm talking about the really dark, not necessarily good tasting, tastes almost like a car oil, smells, but it's really good for your heart. This is from the American College of Cardiology, their annual scientific session. There were several papers presented on the benefits of the omega-3 fatty acids in patients recovering from heart attack. According to a doctor, Raymond Wong, and his associates, there was a randomized study of heart attack survivors who were given standard therapy of 4,000 milligrams of the omega-3 fatty acids or a placebo daily for 6 months. blood samples were analyzed of the omega-3 fatty acids. Theirs came from fish oil. And cardiac magnetic resonance imaging was conducted at 2 to 4 weeks and at the trial's conclusion. Here's what they found. Boy, this is interesting. Quote, blood levels of the omega-3 fatty acids had increased 92% of the omega-3 group, where it did not with the placebo group, which meant that it really made a difference. And so it helps you. It helps heart attack survivors. So all heart attack survivors should be looking at the omega-3 fatty acids. Also, this is from Japan's Tokai University School of Medicine, as published in the peer-reviewed journal Nutrition Research. They found that if you don't have enough of the omega-3 fatty acids, you're at an increased risk of intracerebral hemorrhaging, and that can kill you. So make sure you're getting your omega-3s. There were some reports around that, well, if you have rheumatoid arthritis, you don't want to be taking calcium supplements because it could cause a coronary artery calcification. Well, according to the newest article in the Arthritis and Rheumatology Journal, they found that high levels, very high levels of oral calcium was not associated with an increased risk of coronary atherosclerosis in rheumatoid arthritis patients. And they were taking 1,000 milligrams a day. So take your calcium and, of course, your magnesium. Now, this is from the Journal of the American Medical Association's Internal Medicine. They found that eating a plant-based diet, there's your all your vegetables and your root vegetables and your greens and your nuts and seeds, legumes, pulses and tubers, all that is the way you should eat. But they're suggesting you include fish because it, quote, significantly reduces the risk of colorectal cancer, the second leading cause of cancer-related deaths in America. This was done at Loma Linda University. They tracked 77,000 men and women from Seventh-day Adventist churches for 7 years. And why? Because Seventh-day Adventists were chosen because they abstain from smoking and drinking and typically follow a vegetarian but not necessarily a vegan diet. And during the follow-up, they found that there was a 27% reduced risk of contracting colorectal cancer compared to the non-vegetarians. But those who consumed fish had a 43% reduction. Okay, here's my take on that. I did a clinical study on lifestyle and behavior modification in a group of Seventh-day Adventists up in White Plains. Now, these were almost, well, I think there were 3 or 4 exceptions, but they're almost all Latino or African-American in background. Almost everyone had diseases, diabetes, high blood pressure. They were, at least 90% were overweight, and they had arthritis. And for 6 months, every month, I would go up and do lectures, answer questions, spend about 5-6 hours, and guided them, even showing them how to do power walking. And at the end of 6 months, there was such a remarkable change in health that they decided to engage us as a church-wide program. And the minister and his wife also benefited from it and told me that they would be encouraging their members to follow a healthier lifestyle. So that was the first group as a whole church group that did this. Then there was a group in Brooklyn from Haiti that invited me out, and I gave them the same identical protocol. Again, there was remarkable improvement in those who followed the protocol. Not everyone did, but for those who did, it was so successful that for the next 3 years, every August, I would go out and give another lecture and get more people onto the protocol through a religious group. Now, here's why I think this is so important. Because I believe that if we can engage nationwide all of the different religious groups to look after not just the spiritual consequences of our choice, the moral implications of doing the right thing versus the wrong thing, that's good. But also not to be negligent of the health and the health choices we make. Now, who better than the rabbi or the imam or the minister to be the example? I remember it was 1991, and at the Tri-State Healing Center, there was this morbidly, I'm talking about massively obese man. He was very short. He actually had to turn sideways to get into the door. And he breathed with great difficulty. He was a rabbi from a popular congregation. And I said, what is it you're trying to achieve? And he said, I just don't want to die. And at this point, he wasn't that old, by the way. And I said, I work with people one-on-one when they want to change everything. Other people can help you if you just want to change a few things. And he said, no, I'm willing to change everything. Well, over the next 2 years, he did. And he lost almost 200 pounds. But what was most important was he said how many people in his congregation also were motivated by his change, and they in turn changed. And that was a good thing. So I would like to see a nationwide movement of religious institutions encouraging a healthier lifestyle. I'm willing to travel my own time and my own expense to guide people if it's the entire congregation that's willing to do it, not just for individuals. And because I would like them to have them keep a video diary, members of the congregation film themselves shopping and preparing food and juicing and exercising, and then showing the health of the congregation. Now, they're medical doctors and nurses in virtually almost all the different religious congregations around the United States. But because we're heard worldwide, I'm also willing to Skype meetings with any religious group anywhere in the world. And we're heard right now in almost every country of the world. Some of the most remote places imaginable are listening to this program right now. So let's try to start with the religious groups, because that's where we can get peoples to live longer lives, healthier lives, and just reach out. Now, a little later, I'll give you the email address of Jason here at the Progressive Radio Network, and you can contact him, and then I'll work through Jason, because I'm going to be doing a lot of traveling and helping people over the next month. But this shows that the people with Loma Linda, when you reduce your risk of colorectal cancer by 43%, and mind you, they weren't taking the supplements. That was just vegetarian diet. It wasn't organic vegetarian. There was not a lot of raw food. It did not include any juicing. Had they done what we've done and have high level of accountability with the diet, then there would have been zero chance of colorectal cancer. So therefore, you wouldn't have had to have fish at all. But it's still a good study, and I commend them for doing it and sharing the results with us. Migraines are linked to certain heavy metals, and by the way, let me just give you Jason's email address. So this way, anywhere in the world where you're hearing this, if you'd like your congregation, no matter what religion it is, happy to work with you, if providing that you've gotten the heads of your ministry to agree. It's JTAUBENFELD, Jay Tannenfeld, at GaryNull.com. Jay Tannenfeld at GaryNull.com. TAUBENFELD, Tannenfeld. So, a good study shows that migraines can frequently be triggered by things that we had not considered before, including, according to this study, heavy metals, including lead, has been linked with brain cancer and brain tissue because it crosses the blood-brain barrier, as does aluminum. And therefore, every one of those vaccines that has aluminum, which are most vaccines, it's killing brain tissue, but also can create the basis for seizures and for migraines. What to do? Either medical chelation therapy, EDTA, ethylene, diamine, tetracetic acid, or suppository chelation therapy or juicing with vitamin C at above 1,000 milligrams, especially the green juices, and especially chlorophyll from chlorella and spirulina. That will help reduce migraines, seizures, and get rid of the heavy metals. I'm asked all the time, what would be a safe, meaning non-toxic, effective, meaning having efficacy, choice to vaccines? And the one that comes to mind that I would put at the top of the list would be homeo prophylaxis, or HP for short. Why? Because it educates the immune system. Homeopathy has been around for hundreds of years, and it has helped with a lot of conditions. It's actually FDA approved for pharmacies. In fact, most people are not aware of this, that the FDA was formed by a homeopath named Royal Copeland. And there is a homeopathic pharmacopoeia that's used to explain how these remedies work. Homeopathic remedies can target specific conditions. For example, the biological discharges, such as sputum, or what are called exudates, are used as the original substance. And then it is serially diluted and potentized to create the homeopathic prophylaxis remedies. There is no original molecule of the original disease remaining in the final product. That is called attenuation. A-T-T-E-N-U-A-T-I-O-N, attenuation. Attenuation means in lay language, it weakens the whole molecular structure down. But with the vaccines, there are still some of the original disease products present after attenuation. You still have viruses, you still have bacteria, you still have heavy metals, formaldehyde, mercury. But with homeopathic, the one I mentioned, you don't. And that's the key difference. There's no toxins. So that is what I would recommend. It has been shown to be very beneficial. This homeopathic has been used for cholera, polio, meningitis, and many other diseases, showing effective rates between 85 and 95%. And the Finlay Institute in Cuba, which is one of the world's leading vaccine research and development facilities, has conducted studies using the homeopathic vaccine on dengue fever, hepatitis, and other tropical illnesses with substantial positive results. In comparison, homeoprophylaxis has provided 200 years of clinical evidence showing that it's safe, devoid of any toxic components, and yields positive long-term health benefits. And you have no other vaccines that can state that. Exercising early in life, you live a longer life. University of California at Riverside. And they did this study and found that it works, and they published it in Physiology and Behavior. So that's why getting our children to exercise, keep getting our teenagers to exercise, and never stop exercising, because it's the one thing that's going to help your body have a lowered fat rate, body index, mass index. It's going to help your heart rate beat at a slower rate, which is a longer life for your heart and your body. And it will enhance digestion, it'll enhance detoxification mechanisms, and it'll enhance the feel-good hormones, the endorphins that are released when you exercise. So those are some of the things that are important about health and nutrition. We're going to take a break and come back and continue. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you from all over the world. You're listening to the number one listened to progressive radio program in the world, and we're happy to have you on board. We are not right. We are not left. We are not liberal. We are not conservative. We look for the truth. Wherever that is, that's where we're going to look, as you'll see in a few moments when we get into some commentaries. By the way, on the issues that are important that receive zero attention, Stephen Rosenfeld from AllerNet is now showing us there is a bill very quietly that is getting through the Senate that will eliminate 200,000 Americans from Social Security if they have an arrest warrant. That's correct. The large transportation funding bill moving through the Senate will end Social Security benefits for at least 200,000 people who have an outstanding felony arrest warrant but have never been convicted by any court of a crime. All right, and disability rights advocates are tracking the legislation, and it also sets a precedent of raiding the Social Security funds for unrelated purposes, in this case transferring $2.3 billion for a range of transportation expenses. So it's not good. One more way that they've been playing with our Social Security, and they shouldn't. It's in a package of amendments, 949, Section 52303. It's been added to the transportation bill, and this is how they do things that escape our scrutiny. Now, why should we be concerned about this? For several reasons. Those most likely to lose their Social Security benefits are generally those most in need. A significant number of people will become homeless when they lose their benefits. Some people have had benefits cut off while residing in nursing homes. A very high percentage of those who will lose their benefits are people with intellectual disabilities or mental illness. There's an unusually high percentage of those who will lose benefits are African Americans. Many will lose Medicare outpatient Part B coverage because of an inability to pay the quarterly premium. And eliminating what may be their only source of income does not help resolve these issues. So that's what's at stake here. So those of you who care should protest and let them know. Also from our public health segment today, from Kashmira Gander from The Independent, antidepressants and other psychiatric drugs do more harm than good. Doctors could stop prescribing psychiatric drugs without causing harm. That's according to Professor Peter Gochi. Quote, from The Independent, the negative effects of psychiatric drugs, including those used to treat depression and dementia, outweigh the positives, and that's according to an expert in the clinical field. Professor Peter Gochi, the director of the Nordic Cochrane Center in Copenhagen, has argued that the minimal benefits of psychiatric drugs are not enough to justify the deaths of more than a million people in the world every year. And in this article published in the British Medical Journal, he went on to say that drug trials do not accurately evaluate the side effects of taking many types of medications at once, and said the deaths in such trials are underreported. Citing a study by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, he said he estimated that there are 1,500% more suicides among people than is claimed. He added that his own trial of dementia patients, whom he studied because they are likely to take less drugs than other patients, showed the death rate was higher than those who took a placebo. He went on to express his concern of the three classes of drugs, the antipsychotics and the antidepressants, which he said were responsible for 3,693 deaths every year in Denmark alone. And then in the United States, it's 539,000 deaths because of those psychiatric medications. Quote, given their lack of benefit, I estimate we could stop all psychiatric drugs without causing harm by dropping all antidepressants, ADHD drugs, listen parents, ADHD drugs, he once dropped, dementia drugs dropped. We could save lives. How many? A million people a year. Well, when you have a million people dying who don't need to die, that's a big deal. So I certainly support him in that. Now, this coming, before we go to this, let's hear this. This is about the lie we live. It's a fascinating audio clip from a video clip that raises a lot of interesting questions. And then I'm going to take a moment or two for, once you hear this, to be able to call in and share your thoughts. And I'm going to give you our call-in number in a moment. I'll put it up, and you can call in. It's a different number than what historically we have because we're in new offices now. And also, this coming weekend, I'm going to be on Sunday with a final premiere in the New York area to help the Cinema Arts Center and all the good people out in Long Island, and even some who come from other areas who haven't seen it, my newest documentary, Saving the Planet. It's at noon. You can call for information, 631-423-7611, 631-423-7611. But on Saturday, something a lot of fun, from noon to 2 hours, I'm going to be at 89th and Broadway giving free samples out of my newest invention. Well, 7 inventions. Something really tasty, raw and fresh. I made them up myself, and I'll be there for 2 hours. So if you want to, I don't want to talk about it on the air, but if you want to come and try something original, one of a kind, 7 of them, Saturday, noon to 2, 89th and Broadway. I'll be there, and you can come in and try some for yourself. All right? Something fun. Now let's hear some statements from The Lie We Live, and then you can call afterwards at 888-874-4888. That's the correct number, 888-874-4888.
At this moment, you could be anywhere, doing anything. Instead, you sit alone before a screen. So what's stopping us from doing what we want, being where we want to be? Each day we wake up in the same room and follow the same path to live the same day as yesterday. Yet at one time, each day was a new adventure. Along the way, something changed. Before, our days were timeless. Now our days are scheduled. Is this what it means to be grown up? To be free? But are we really free? Food, water, land, the very elements we need to survive are owned by corporations. There's no food for us on trees. No fresh water in streams. No land to build a home. If you try and take what the earth provides, you'll be locked away. So we obey their rules. We discover the world through a textbook. For years we sit and regurgitate what we're told, tested and graded, like subjects in a lab. Raised not to make a difference in this world. Raised to be no different. Smart enough to do our job, but not to question why we do it. So we work and work. Left with no time to live the life we work for. Until a day comes when we are too old to do our job. It is here we're left to die. Our children take our place in the game. To us, our path is unique. But together we are nothing more than fuel. The fuel that powers the elite. The elite who hide behind the logos of corporations. This is their world. And their most valuable resource is not in the ground. It is us. We build their cities. We run their machines. We fight their wars. After all, money isn't what drives them. It's power. Money is simply the tool they use to control us. Worthless pieces of paper we depend on to feed us, move us, entertain us. They gave us money, and in return, we gave them the world. Where there are trees that cleaned our air are now factories that poison it. Where there was water to drink is toxic waste that stinks. Where animals ran free are factory farms where they are born and slaughtered endlessly. For our satisfaction. Over 1 billion people are starving, despite us having enough food for everybody. Where does it all go? 70% of the grain we grow is fed to the animals you eat for dinner. Why help the starving? You can't profit off them. We are like a plague sweeping the earth, tearing apart the very environment that allows us to live. We see everything as something to be sold, as an object to be owned. But what happens when we have polluted the last river, poisoned the last breath of air, have no oil for the trucks that bring us our food? When will we realize money can't be eaten, that it has no value? We aren't destroying the planet, we're destroying all life on it. Every year, thousands of species go extinct, and time is running out before we're next. If you live in America, there's a 41% chance you'll get cancer. Heart disease will kill 1 out of 3 Americans. We take prescription drugs to deal with these problems, but medical care is the third leading cause of death behind cancer and heart disease. We're told everything can be solved by throwing money at scientists so they can discover a pill to make our problems go away. But the drug companies and cancer societies rely on our suffering to make a profit. We think we're running for a cure, but really we're running away from the cause. Our body is a product of what we consume, and the food we eat is designed purely for profit. We fill ourselves with toxic chemicals, the bodies of animals infested with drugs and diseases. But we don't see this. The small group of corporations that own the media don't want us to, surrounding us with a fantasy we're told is reality. It's funny to think humans once thought the Earth was the center of the universe. But then again, now we see ourselves as the center of the planet. We point to our technology and say we're the smartest. But do our computers, cars, and factories really illustrate how intelligent we are? Or do they show how lazy we've become? We put this civilized mask on, but when you strip that away, what are we? How quickly we forget only within the past 100 years did we allow women to vote, allow blacks to live as equals. We act as if we're all-knowing beings, yet there's much we fail to see. We walk down the street ignoring the little things, the eyes who stare, the stories they share, seeing everything as a background to me. Perhaps we fear we're not alone, that we're a part of a much bigger picture. But we fail to make the connection. We're okay killing pigs, cows, chickens, strangers from foreign lands, but not our neighbors, not our dogs or cats, those we have come to love and understand. We call other creatures stupid, yet we point to them to justify our actions. But does killing simply because we can, because we always have, make it right? Or does it show how little we've learned, that we continue to act out of primal aggression, rather than thought and compassion? One day, the sensation we call life will leave us. Our bodies will rot, our valuables recollected. Yesterday's actions all that remain. Death constantly surrounds us. Still, it seems so distant from our everyday reality. We live in a world on the verge of collapse. The wars of tomorrow will have no winners. For violence will never be the answer. It will destroy every possible solution. If we all look at our innermost desire, we will see our dreams are not so different. We share a common goal, happiness. We tear the world apart looking for joy, without ever looking within ourselves. Many of the happiest people are those who own the least. But are we really so happy with our iPhones, our big houses, our fancy cars? We've become disconnected, idolizing people we've never met. We witness the extraordinary on screens, but ordinary everywhere else. We wait for someone to bring change, without ever thinking of changing ourselves. Presidential elections might as well be a coin toss. It's two sides of the same coin. We choose which face we want, and the illusion of choice, of change, is created. But the world remains the same. We fail to realize the politicians don't serve us. They serve those who fund them in the power. We need leaders, not politicians. But in this world of followers, we have forgotten to lead ourselves. Stop waiting for change and be the change you want to see. We didn't get to this point by sitting on our asses. The human race survived not because we are the fastest or the strongest, but because we work together. We have mastered the act of killing. Now let's master the joy of living.
Now let's hear a short piece from Roger Waters, Amused to Death.
Education system, particularly in this country, is totally impoverished. That's why the United States ranks like 40th in the world for educational standards. Whereas the money tends to get spent in advertising and broadcasting the lie that we're the best, we are exceptional, we are the greatest nation on earth, we are this, we are that, we are the other. How dare you say that about America? We're absolutely... Well, hold on a minute. The data exists. Your education system is number 40. You're somewhere between Zaire and the Belgian Congo. I'm not saying that's literally true, but it's sort of a bit... Why? You're the richest country on earth, without any question. You spend more than the whole of the rest of the world put together on killing people. and yet your education system sucks. You have one or two or three or maybe four great universities which are acknowledged all over the world as being great. But in the rest of the top 100 universities, you don't have any, because this is a supremely elitist society. It has nothing to do with what the founding fathers want. The point that I'm making is that whoever we are, wherever we live, whatever color we are, whatever our religion is, whatever our political status, we need to reach out to each other to discover what it is in each individual human being that can understand the predicament of the other and stop going, I'm the good guy, you're the bad guy, which unfortunately seems to be something that people naturally gravitate towards. I think it's probably because we live in such controlled and difficult circumstances that we all feel insignificant and insecure. We're brought up to go, buy bubblegum, go and kill these people over there. That is a bad person, bad, bad, you know, treating the rest of the world like dogs. Sit, stop that, how dare, right, go and bomb them. If you grow up in that, also, in a thing where if you don't do as you're told, that you get punished, you know. Go and cook hamburgers, we'll give you $7 an hour. Okay, you know, sorry, I didn't mean to do anything wrong. I mean, they're still arguing about $15 an hour as a minimum wage in this country. How insane is that? I did think it was good. Obama said, if you think you can look after a family on 15 grand a year, go and try it.
Your thoughts. Talk back. 888-874-4888. Let's say hello to John from Pennsylvania. Hi, John. Your turn.
Hey, Gary. Thanks so much for everything you do and appreciate your comments about Dr. Gonzalez. That was fantastic. Could you share, if you don't mind, I hear you talk about how to cook in a way where you could put your finger in the pan so it doesn't burn the food. So I was wondering, is there a way that you could describe or maybe film it at an upcoming retreat where you are post it?
Well, I'll be happy to do that. In fact, I'm filming at an upcoming retreat a whole lot of things, including sprouting, microgreen production, how to make the healthiest juice to start your day by how to actually harvest ginger, peel it, and juice it with lemon, fresh whole lemons and wheatgrass, and I'll also be doing cooking classes, and I'll show how to, what kind of oils to use depending upon what temperature you're getting to and how to bring it gradually up to a temperature and what kind of utensils to use. I'll be happy to do that. Yes. Lincoln from Mount Vernon. Lincoln, your turn.
Hey, how are you, Gary?
Good, thank you.
Great. Long time. Yeah, you know, I want to say this, Dom. I was listening to especially the video on money, and I've been saying that since I was 20 years old. But when you're not famous, no one listens to you. Jesus said a wonderful thing, and people don't pay attention to it. He said, life does not consist of the abundance of things. And concerning money, I've always said that money is really, it's not real, and it's a psychological ploy to control the people. How is it this country, they say that they're broke, but yet they can always find trillions to wage wars, and it's because money is not real. And we keep saying this thing, it's a big fallacy that America is the richest country in the world. It is not the richest country in the world, because true wealth is natural resources. And that's the reason why they can use gold, and then they can, as a standard bearer, and then they can do away with it, and then they can bring it back. And I want to add another thing, wish I had much more time. Money is really like religion, and economics is really like a religion. It's lies that have been perpetrated on us, and then we start treating it like it's a truism, like all this financial crisis that you're talking about. It is not real. Africa did not suffer from a financial deficit before Europeans came, because we are controlled by definitions, and we did not utilize their so-called definitions, economic definitions. Likewise, Native Americans,
Lincoln,
they were not.
Lincoln, you will not be able to breathe if you don't exhale. You got to slow it down, buddy. You've made a lot of very valid points, and I appreciate them. We've got to go to our guest in a moment in London, but while we're getting our guest up, let's say hello. Real quick comments, please. Zach from Long Island. Real quick, Zach.
Hi, Gary.
Hi.
I was just listening to the two clips that you played on the,
yes,
on the show, and I just have a response to the two of them. They both seem, I liked both of them a lot, but they both suggested this idea that you know, there is no, we all need to look into the eyes of the enemy and be more compassionate for their perspective. But, you know, I followed a lot of threads in all these things going on in the world, lots of things you talk about, and it seems to me that we do have certain entities, interests that are evil by nature and are trying to dehumanize the entire situation. I always wonder, I always bounce back and forth with this spiritually. What is the balance?
Okay.
What is the balance for us? Because it seems like there is a force that needs to be countered against.
See, I don't see evil as an individual entity. I see evil as the absence of spirituality. And therefore, I believe that we must understand how good people do bad things. How did they go from being good to being bad in what they do? How did they go from being spiritual to genocide, killing people, hating people, which is manifest as evil, but it didn't start off as evil. So therefore, if we accept that someone is evil, they weren't born evil. It's an evolution. So we have to be patient and take our time and look at everything that participated in that person's evolution from one mindset to another mindset, the maladaptation, conscious or unconscious, that leads us astray. And should we be compassionate? We should be compassionate with the idea that it is only by understanding how someone managed to get to be so toxic, so negative, that we can learn their lessons, because rarely do people who manifest genocide, hatred, bigotry, racism, do they ever change? So this might seem a paradox, but I believe that we are gifted by learning the enemy's lessons at the spiritual level so we don't become them. Because if you start engaging in an eye for an eye, then you become that which you despise. Let us take a break, come back with our guest. Please stay with us. Appreciate your insight. Nice to have you with us, everyone. Joining us by Skype in London, United Kingdom, is Professor William Davies, a sociologist, political economist, and a senior lecturer at Goldsmiths at the University of London, where he is also director of the Political Economy Research Center. His focus has been on the critiquing the social impact of neoliberal capitalism and the role of technology and the internet and surveillance in shaping public interest and the popular secular psychology. He is the author of a recently released The Happiness Industry, How Government and Big Business Sold Us Well-Being. And his articles can be found on the blog potlatch.org.uk. Nice to have you with us today.
Yes, nice to be here.
When we think about the popular movements of happiness and well-being, we usually think of the New Age gurus on our television and best-selling book lists, or the popularity of the positive psychology movement and mindful meditation techniques. However, there is another side of the happiness movement that is found in another body of research and disciplines in conventional psychology, and this is what is being incorporated by government and industry to sell us promises of happiness and well-being, regardless of how detrimental to society our capitalist and pro-neoliberal government regimes are. And this derived more from conventional science, such as brain research and behavioral psychology and neuroscience. And I assume that aspects of the positive psychology movement fall into this category also because it arose from the universities such as Harvard and the University of Pennsylvania. So please begin by first laying out for us the fundamental scientific premises of the happiness industry that is most relied upon by government and big business.
certainly. There's a long history to this, and in the book, I start it a long way back in the late 18th century with the work of Jeremy Bentham, the English philosopher. And Bentham was the first philosopher who argued that not only was happiness the most important value in human life and in society, but also that government should take steps to try and measure it and to orient their public policies and their laws around maximizing it in a quantitative, calculated fashion. So this, as an ideal for modern liberal government and also for business, has a long history, and it's been very important in the history of economics as well. And neoclassical economics, which dates back to the late 19th century, revives that same Benthamite agenda in some ways. But I think in terms of what we're looking at today, I think the starting point is much more recent. It's a period during the 1990s when not only was positive psychology on the rise very rapidly, to the point where it's now in many ways the dominant field of psychology in the United States, but also neuroscience was gaining a broader audience. It was becoming influential in areas such as marketing and market research. But also there was the growth of the field of happiness economics. Happiness economics really begins when orthodox economists start to pay interest in survey data on what's called reported life satisfaction. So asking people questions such as, broadly speaking, how satisfied are you with your life? Economists started to pick up some of the survey data during the 1990s to understand how different aspects of markets, different aspects of our working lives, our private lives, our social lives affect our psychology. Because by and large, economists had dropped their interest in psychology through most of the 20th century. Now, put all of these things together and you have various scientific tools, various techniques and methods through which our subjective psychological emotional states can become understood, or perhaps understood is perhaps not the right word, but assessed, evaluated, audited by a range of techniques in the social sciences. But added to that are various technological techniques which have come a long way, partly with the internet, but which aim to collect data that we often give off unwittingly as to how we are feeling on various emotional scales.
The positive psychology movement right now is extremely popular in the United States. Its gurus receive huge salaries and fees for promoting its principles to make us happy in workplaces, as you just mentioned, where an employer actually has every right to be dissatisfied or disgusted with bosses or the working conditions or whatever. You mentioned that the danger here is that the entire emphasis is placed upon simply changing our psychological perspective on conditions, for example, the fact that the U.S. is now an oligarchical police state, but get over it and just get happy and entertain yourself rather than promoting changing conditions. Please address this further.
Yes, I think one of the intriguing aspects of the happiness science and happiness discourse, and also one of the very disappointing aspects of it, is that its roots lie in some quite idealistic, emancipatory ideas from the 1960s, ideas from humanist psychology, ideas from what was called the social indicators movement, which tried to challenge the primacy of monetary measures in public life, such as gross domestic product, and try and offer alternative, more critical bases for evaluating right and wrong in public life. Now, from that starting point, I think what's happened to happiness science is that regardless of its good intentions at various stages along the way, it has switched from being a basis to criticize societies, criticize corporate power, criticize inequality, or the rampant competitiveness that is known to be bad for us psychologically. It's known that various aspects of a highly materialistic, individualistic highly competitive culture is a contributing factor to depression. This is well understood within various other disciplines such as social epidemiology and so on. But I think what happened somewhere along the way is that the critical focus of happiness science switches away from institutions, from collective entities, from governments, from business structures and so on, towards individuals which are suffering as a result of some of those external factors, in order to say to people, look, here's what you can do to stop suffering in this way. Here's what you can do to change the way in which you perceive your environment, feel about your environment. You can undertake mindfulness exercises. You can try and change your cognitive framing. You can change aspects of your behavior or your diet, or as lots of these wearable technologies like Jawbones and Fitbits now encourage us to do, try and change your sleeping patterns and that sort of thing. So the entire thrust of this critical agenda switches around 180 degrees away from the institutions that in many ways condition the feelings and the emotional responses we have, towards the feelings and the emotional responses themselves, to say you can't do anything about your circumstances, but you can do something about how you respond to them. This is a repeated mantra of positive psychology: is what happens to you is beyond your control, how you respond is within your control. And so in some ways it grossly individualizes what had begun once as quite a political agenda. And at the same time, I think it then reinforces many of the aspects of our society today, which in some ways are contributory factors in the first place to feelings of depression, of anxiety, of feelings of inadequacy, because it reinforces the sense in which we are responsible for how we respond to what happens to us. We are responsible for our mental health. We are responsible for our physical health, our well-being. All of these things are things that we have to take charge of, just like we have to take charge of our bodies by going to the gym and so on. So it kind of reinforces a cycle of feelings of inadequacy, feelings of individual responsibility, whereas in some ways, happiness to me might actually involve a discourse which said, no, this wasn't your fault. Sometimes it's your fault. On this occasion, no, it's not. Actually, there are things that are happening to you which are beyond your control, and they're not entirely beyond your control collectively, but you're not to blame for everything that happens to you. You're not to blame for your feelings or for your feelings of unhappiness in certain situations.
Final question. I have people such as Chris Hedges, Henry Giroux, coming on this program and speaking about America and Europe and their addiction to pleasure and self-indulgent entertainment that has numbed critical thinking. And we are constantly being bombarded with inane images and rhetoric that go to the lowest common denominator of our psyche. Hedges and Giroux and others would claim this benefits the neoliberal economic regime. And then you take a look at how does the industry of happiness and well-being undermine democratic participation in society that you were just referring to, and particularly in furthering more compassion and social programs that raise up those at the bottom of the economic ladder. We only have about 2.5 minutes for your answer, please. How does the happiness industry undermine democracy?
I suppose at its core, at the frontier of the science of happiness is the idea that human beings are not to be trusted as representatives of their own feelings. There's a market researcher called Martin Lindstrom who uses neuromarketing research, and one of his slogans is, humans lie, but brains don't. So this idea that the body is a more authoritative indicator of our pleasures, of our feelings, of our desires than we are. Now, to my mind, that is inevitably a silencing of human voice or a circumventing of human voice in certain ways. So if someone would say, I'm unhappy because of this injustice, the response of some of the happiness industry would be to say, well, I don't care why you think you're unhappy. I'm going to go and find out why actually scientifically you're unhappy. So the narrative which says this injustice or this situation is causing me to feel unhappy, which is a primary starting point for politics and for resistance, becomes, I would argue, silenced in favor of a science which says, I'm going to actually discover through observation why your brain or your body or your feelings responds to certain stimuluses in the way that it does.
I appreciate that answer. And of course, more information from reading the book itself. Thank you very much for being on with us, The Happiness Industry, Professor William Davies from Great Britain.
Great. Thank you very much.
Bye. We're out of time, everyone. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on tomorrow's program. Have a nice day.
Sending out a message around the world.
Y'all hear me? Y'all hear me?